Welcome. I'm so excited to be introducing Art and Eloise this evening. But before I do, I'm just going to give you a quick overview of the next upcoming programs. On September 27th and 28th is the Dogtown Writers Festival that Eileen mentioned. That is a festival which has panels of art of writers, as well as a workshop that you can, there's various workshops, Sandy Tolan, just all sorts of great people that are coming out. And that's a two-day event. On October 9th, we are doing a co-event with the Cape Ann Plein Air, where the artists are going out and doing paintings, and we are having writers go out and do writings about the art and about the views, so kind of a coordinated effort, which I think sounds kind of fun, being a painter and not a writer. And on October 26th, at the Cape Ann Museum is the Charles Olson Lecture that's being given by Stephen Friedman. So those are the upcoming events. I know Art and Eloise as my neighbors, my closest neighbors actually, and also through the Bell family, who I love dearly. They are the aunt and uncle of that family. But they have been writing books, which I find extraordinary because that is a great endeavor, and clearly supporting each other in that event. They dedicated all of their books to each other, which I love. Eloise has written a memoir, Wishbone, which will be available in the back at the end of the event. It's really special to read this book because I hear the stories that I've heard from the Bell family come out through this, as well as an arts book, which is Night's Trails, and has a second flip side book in it, which I love that idea, which is sort of a peak of the mountain trail to the parlor, which I think is really interesting. So, but I'm gonna let them tell you about their books, and so we'll just get started. But before I do, I just wanna give a shout out to their niece, Winnie, who is watching for the live stream, which is going on right now in Hanoi. So across the world, someone is watching this event. So I think that's kind of fun.
And Helen's watching up in Maine.
Oh, is she? Yeah, see? Yeah, so I love the live stream because a lot of people can touch base with what we're doing without leaving home. So if it's raining, you know, you can still see what's going on. But anyways, I'm not sure who was going to read first. Eloise. So Eloise, come on up.
Yes. Thank you so much for inviting us. Both of us say thank you. And I just want to say this is a first for the Hodges. Our special thanks go to Henry Farini and to Simone, who extended the invitation, and to a slew of Bells, most especially Mac. We are honored. I'm going to start by reading three essays from Wishbone. It turned out to be a kind of memoir, but has no true narrative arc. The pieces fell into place by themselves, in fragments, just like life itself. The first one is titled Happy as a Lamb, and I would put it in the late 50s. My parents had moved to Dolliver's Neck in Gloucester in 1955, where they created a little bit of heaven on earth. Though wartime had ended 10 years before, there were glimmers of it now and then. So here it is, happy as a lamb. Most afternoons, my mother would go to the bedroom and take a nap. An interregnum between the morning that dawned early and the afternoon that stretched through errands, phone calls, carpools, and preparing dinner. A hasty and unloved exercise. She didn't shut the door. She just took off her glasses, dropped them on the bedside table, slipped off her shoes, and slid under the quilt. Hands tucked under her chin, legs drawn up, she was like a doe, drawing new energy in the quiet of the woods. In minutes, she was fast asleep, partitioned off from the rest of us in spite of the open door. When I looked in, I could barely hear her breathing, Her body was a quiet lump, facing large windows with views of our lawn and the long-legged oak trees. Was she dreaming? Had we been banished from her thoughts? I wasn't sure, but in less than 15 minutes, she would reach for her glasses and shoes and come find us. The slam of the screen door was the high point of the day, usually around 6 p.m. when my father got home. He would call, "Yoo-hoo!" in a loud voice from the bottom of the stairs and begin to climb in his bouncy way to the top where my mother stood to greet him. "Hi, darling," she would exclaim and wrap her arms around his neck. "How did it go?" 40 winks, my father would mutter as he lay on the large sofa in our living room, both hands tucked under his cheek. It was an announcement, not a command, for us to be quiet. He could sleep anywhere, always positioned with one leg bent for a leap into action. Were memories of Burma springing to life in his head? Japanese and rifle shots? Oh no, he's smiling, looks content. "Happy as a lamb," my mother would say. My mother was a tireless letter writer. Part of each day she sat at her desk in a corner of the bedroom, her hand galloping across a piece of stationery, often the airmail kind and light as a feather. Her words were readable but loose-knit, letters hinged together with loops that tried to make connections but usually failed. Only a few paragraphs got periods, and just before the end of a page, words spilled out at a pronounced tilt. She wrote thank yous for dinners and weekend visits, birthday notes to her grandchildren, ones that crossed the sea to old friends, some to a poet in Dublin who had courted her 40 years ago. When he replied, she'd exclaim, "Oh, a letter from Terence," and tear it open with girlish glee. My mother always tucked his letters into one of the cubby holes in her desk. Sometimes she would leave a letter that had just arrived, open for anyone to see. In passing, my father would peer down with a smile, just looking, not reading, never jealous. From 1943 to 45, she wrote my father every day, while he was in combat. Her letters, dropped by parachute, miraculously found him in the steaming jungle. He saved hers, she saved his. He had an orderly script, hers sprawled across the page, telling him every detail of our lives at home. Just imagine, silky tissue floating from the sky to machine guns and rifles, muddy boots and bandaged heroes, the furor of war briefly becalmed by my mother's news from home. My second essay is extremely short, and I knew for tonight's reading I had to have one about sailing. And so here is Frostbiting, which features my father and my youngest sister, Helen. This is a wild sport, a sailing contest in icy January. Always, there are kinks and twists before these two get underway. That's my sister Helen, 11 years old, hauling on a line to tame this preposterous dinghy. Like a wild pony, it won't stay still in the harbor's froth. She's got to keep it steady for my father, who has his eye fixed on the top of the mast. Something is jammed, the halyard maybe, and the tiny sail resists his pull. Size of a handkerchief, it's stubborn, and the canvas flaps. He's pushed his tongue over his lower lip, a childhood quirk that pops up whenever he meets a challenge. And Helen's teeth are bared, eyes squeezed shut, mouth wide enough for us to see the gap on the upper right. Why, she's nothing but a cub wrapped in foul weather gear. The race is about to start, only 2 minutes to go, An impatient little chop slaps the dinghy's belly. Temperature 20 degrees, wind 15 knots, a gray day under a gunmetal sky. Seawater grunting as it circles these clumsy sailors. Get on with it, it seems to say. My father, my sister, they're a prickly team locked in a league of intrepid frostbiters. Who says this is fun? My sister hated it. The youngest child, she's the only one my father can recruit as crew. It fans her spirit, though, will propel her one day to Haiti, Rwanda, Pakistan, to nurse ravaged people who populate the saddest spots in the world. As for my father, he blooms into a world-class skipper, just 52 in this photo. He graduates to racing trimarans that fly like silken steeds with wings. At 65, he sails solo in a race across the Atlantic from Plymouth, England to Newport, Rhode Island, winning in record time, 17 days, 23 hours, and 12 minutes. These two don't know it, but they are a formidable team. And in Wishbone on page 84, you'll see a photo of them in one of these races. We're trying to get ready for one. I think I might get a little bit of water before I keep going. This one is entitled Home Pastures, and it's about our own family, Art's and mine. And it's the early 90s. We have three children, two now married, who are home for Christmas. A walk in the woods kicks up deep memories. Whenever our children scattered in Denver, Los Angeles, and Pittsburgh come home to Essex for Christmas, we go for a walk in the woods. Cold air nips our faces as we parade along the old bridle path dusted with snow. Our corgis race ahead, running back often to check on us until we reach the barn where my cousins used to live, facing a meadow dotted with cedar trees. It's beautiful here, announces our daughter, Susanna, making a generous sweep with her arm. I can see building a house right there. She points to the hill above the meadow where a few old apple trees bask in the afternoon light. The others stop to look. Arthur, our oldest, with his arm around his wife's son, he. Alex, our youngest, hands on his hips. Yeah, they agree in unison, their faces flickering with interest. We cross the meadow in a wide line, then climb through thick brush, re-entering the woods on a different path that winds through a stream bed. Hands in his pockets, Arthur jumps from rock to keep his sneakers dry. The corgis, smelling home, fly ahead on their short legs. We get back to the house refreshed, just as darkness collects in the tops of the trees. Vast memories crowd in as we take the Christmas walk. Our family, house, and these rocks and woods have encircled my life for 40 years. I lived here as a little girl with my parents, three sisters, and a brother, and came back with Art after we'd been married just 2 years. Arthur was a baby then, sleeping in a carriage on the lawn next to the apple tree, which blew to the ground on a windy night last week. I remember what it was like to be a child here, living close to my grandmother and my cousins. At the top of the hill on the same driveway, she lived alone in a brick house with more than 20 rooms. The front hall was dark and ticked with the sounds of a grandfather clock. My cousins, three unruly boys, lived on the other side of a swamp, in a farmhouse near the barn that still stands today. I could run up the driveway to my grandmother's in less than 2 minutes and dash in dirty sneakers along a rocky path to my cousin's in less than 5. We didn't see my grandmother, whom we called Dinny, every day, but she telephoned a lot. I watched my mother go to the phone. Hi, Ma, how are you? she'd say with a sigh. Like a bird with clipped wings, she listened to Denny's tiresome chatter, inserting just a word or two here and there. At least once a week, Denny invited my mother for lunch. As the oldest granddaughter, I was often taken along, plunked like a buffer between them. Denny greeted us at the door, dressed smartly in bright linen, high color on her cheeks, hair swept up with a mix of pins and combs. We followed her through the formal dining room to the breakfast room with a brick floor and French windows. She sat at one end of the glass table, my mother at the other. I was in the middle. Harold the butler dipped in and out of the room. The conversation skittered on thin ice, going nowhere, until Denny, lifting her soup spoon, looked across the table and said, "Annie, dear, you look so tired." My mother, dark circles under her eyes, tensed and clenched her jaw. Not waiting for a reply, Denny sailed on to other topics, satisfied she'd stuck the needle where she intended. My father, a restless subject in Denny's kingdom, spent weekends clearing paths in the woods, uprooting the bullbriar that made certain stretches impassable. A prickly mesh of green, the briar thrived without the sun, climbing in dense thickets around the trunks of the pine trees. Wearing heavy gloves, he burned tangled piles on cold winter days. Out of range of his mother-in-law, he whistled tunes in the frosty air, pounding his gloves to call our English setters if they strayed too far. The war with the bullbriar fortified him, linked him to the woods he didn't own. But every year, the briar grew back, scaling new heights on neighboring trees. When I was 15, my mother and father declared their independence and moved away from Essex to a point of land overlooking the entrance to Gloucester Harbor. 8 years later, Art and I took their place, moving into the house I grew up in. But we claimed the land as if it were our own, particularly Art, who was immune to the family ghosts. He found a rusty power saw in the garage, and soon after we settled in, cut down a dozen pines on the south side of the house to let in the sun. I have a photo of him surrounded by the felled trees, their green-needled boughs lopped like carcasses in a wide swath. His foot rests on a trunk and a smile of victory curls his lips. But my mother, sweeping in with my grandmother's fury, soon telephoned from Gloucester, "Tell Art no more trees are to come down. Absolutely no more until he's cleared away what he's taken down already." Inside the house, we arranged the furniture in patterns cautiously resembling those of the past. It was hard not to. A lot of what we had were pieces my grandmother owned or my mother had given us. The oak dining room table and sideboard, the frayed oriental rug that covered the wide pine floors in the living room, the dark mahogany guest room beds with matching bureau and side table. They leapt to their appointed places while shadows of the past flitted through the rooms. One of the first afternoons after we moved in, my mother and father came up to our bedroom, which had been theirs. They sat on our bed, placed exactly as theirs had been, along the north wall by the window that looked out to the view. "Now where's that little cedar we planted?" my father asked, leaning forward to get a better look. "It should be just below that row of hemlocks." We looked, it wasn't. Suddenly I remembered, Art had cut it down a few weekends before. Dense and spear-shaped, it blocked a clearing he was trying to open below the house. Without a thought, he'd removed it, certain my parents wouldn't notice. There was a silence, a certain sadness, but it didn't last long. My father was giving us space to stretch, Latitude my grandmother had refused him for years. Now the house stretches and flexes to make room for our children. Susanna takes the small room with a futon at the end of the hall, sleeping solo because Eric, her husband, has Christmas duty in the emergency room at Harbor Medical Center in LA. Arthur and Sunhee take the bedroom facing south, which fills with the afternoon sun. Alex takes his old bedroom across the hall. Doors open and shut, showers run, water rushes through pipes, dormant for months. Art starts a fire in the living room. We draw the curtains and the walls sparkle with light. Soon the children leave at intervals. First Susanna on Sunday morning before the sun is up. She sits in the front seat of our station wagon, clutching herself against the cold. Mom, can't we get some heat in here? She asks in a tone that reminds me of early morning carpools. As the heat fills the car, she brightens. Eric said it was 75 degrees yesterday. He was lying in our hammock in the garden. When we reach the end of Apple Street and head down Southern Avenue towards Route 128, frost shimmers in the air. We pass the yellow farm, postcard perfect in the morning light, the pond below it circled by weeping willows in frozen stances. Unseeing, Susanna puts her feet on the dashboard and snuggles closer to the heat. We tuck all the way to the airport, feeling the time grow short. It will be 2 months before I see her again. The house is quiet now. The beds lie stripped and unmade. Soon I will remake them, drop the quilts down, smooth out the wrinkles, let the beds doze in silence until the children's next visit. It may be months, certainly a full year, before they'll all be here at the same time. The dogs follow me through the empty rooms, looking thoughtful. They like the noise and company. The house was a different place, the hours alive with new rhythms. Surrounded by the newspapers, Art and I relax in the study. The children have come and gone. We discuss them, we share, we ruminate, we analyze. Gradually, our conversation moves to our own things. I shift in my chair, where I sit near Art most every night at the end of the day. I think of our children in their separate cities, going back to their own lives, the particles of our family briefly fused, now split apart like atoms in the night sky. I contemplate the rest of my life on this lovely place, where I grew up, where my mother grew up, which my grandmother created. It seems suddenly flat and dull, a backdrop that will yield no surprises, and I envy our children's easy egress from home pastures. Perhaps it's the darkness, the winter closing in, the empty house. An arrow of panic plunges somewhere near my heart. Exam, and then following that, I guess we'll have questions and answers.
Well, you are a hard act to follow.
Yes.
So, good evening. It's a great honor to be asked to speak before the Gloucester Writers, which boasts of luminaries like Charles Olson and Vincent Farini. I'd also like to express our thanks to all those who made this evening possible, especially Simone and Henry and Mac, too. I have recently published two novellas, both of which are available on Kindle. I have also, incidentally, I don't make a lot of money out of Kindle. I got a credit in my bank account today for $1.22. And when I did my income tax return, the 10K from Amazon was $17.03. I also brought 10 copies of the book, which are available to take home tonight, and I'm sorry that I didn't have enough for everybody to get one. But I hope you can make a contribution to the Gloucester Writer Center, as we've heard tonight. So, first, Open Book Exam is a story about four couples who are members of a book club and who meet periodically over dinner. It was written over the last 2 years and completed in 2018. Now, let me have a show of hands. How many here are members of a book club? I know you. Okay, good. I think a lot of people are, obviously. The plot is about four upper-middle-class white couples living in western Connecticut, Litchfield and Fairfield counties. And while they may legitimately be considered as being privileged, most of them have been wounded over the years in one way or another, so that their discussion often migrates towards wrestling with one of life's eternal mysteries, why bad things happen to good people. I'll save that for last if we have enough time. Now let's turn to Night Trail, which is a bit shorter than Open Book Exam. It's 121 pages versus 149. I wrote the first version in the late 1980s when I was hiking the Appalachian Trail in southern New England. I rewrote it last year after I finished Open Book Exam. It takes place in October 1986 and involves two middle-aged brothers who take some time off to hike the trail for a week in Massachusetts and Connecticut. So here's a quick summary to get you started. Rob Hammond is a very successful 50-year-old investment advisor who's happily married to Cynthia. They live in Chestnut Hill. His brother, Tuck, is 45 and teaches in a private boarding school in New Hampshire. They are joined at the last minute, sort of a blind date for Tuck, by a 42-year-old teacher named Ann Cushing, who also likes to hike, and who convinced Tuck over the phone to let her join them for 2 days on the trail. There's a fourth person, a young woman, who plays a major role later in the novella, and she's my favorite character. And a lot of people who read the book say, gee, we really like her. In contrast to Open Book Exam, Night Trail is more of an adventure book, although there is some thoughtful discussion about life and death when the characters sit down for dinner in an inn along the trail. I have also attempted to, throughout the book, to convey some sense of the beauty of that section of New England in the fall. Once again, I may be accused with some justification of writing yet another WASP novel. But Tuck is a somewhat troubled Vietnam veteran wrestling with work-related frustrations and no love life. And Anne is an unhappy, bitter woman with her own personal problems. Their hiking blind date turns out to be rather disastrous, and they end up arguing with each other whenever they get the chance. She much prefers Rob, the investment advisor, but unfortunately, he's happily married. So I'd like to read a few pages from an early section in the book. It's late October of 1986. Rob and Tuck started hiking by themselves in Lee, Massachusetts, a day ago, and they met Anne in an inn in Monterey, which is located just south of the Massachusetts Turnpike. They spent the night there, and this morning the three of them started hiking together south along the Appalachian Trail towards Mount Everett, which is in western Massachusetts at the corner of New York and Connecticut. The mountain has a very exposed summit with an elevation of 2,600 feet. They have been hiking all day, and it is late, and the weather looks ominous. At 4 o'clock, they break out of the woods, and in a few minutes arrive at the summit. As the afternoon has worn on, the sun has disappeared again, and the wind has picked up. The air has become cold and raw, whipping around the bare rocks at the bottom of the fire tower and threatening a dangerous night. They stop for a quick break behind some boulders to map out their strategy. Rob reads the trail guide out loud with the aid of his half-moon reading glasses which he extracted from his windbreaker pocket and which are partly fogged. They have slightly more than an hour of daylight left to find a campsite and cook dinner before dark. I don't think we're going to make it to Sage's Ravine in time, he says. Tuck says, well, let's go as far as we can. Anne, are you still game? I know we've come a long way. She says, as long as we find something more protected than this place, you couldn't get a tent peg into these rocks with a jackhammer. They find a trail marker on the rock indicating the way off the mountain and set off as rapidly as they can after 19 miles of walking. Rob is walking with a slight limp from soreness in his knees. Anne has a small blister on one of her toes. It begins to spit rain, stinging their faces from the wind. The trail leads along at the edge of an escarpment, which drops vertically several hundred feet, just a few steps to the left of them. Rob wonders how many hikers have stumbled over the edge in the darkness. In spite of his knees, he's enjoying the challenge, and of course his crazy brother Tuck is in seventh heaven. Anne seems okay, not a bad girl. Tuck was lucky to get her, although she doesn't seem to appear to be that interested in him. In half an hour, they realize it is time to stop. They have descended off the highest elevation and have reached the tree line. They find a small grove of pines situated 50 yards below the exposed cliff and decide that this will be their campsite for the night. They drop their packs and begin to set up as quickly as they can in the waning twilight. Rob picks out a place for their two-man tent while Tuck begins to prepare dinner. Anne chooses a spot a few yards away behind a juniper bush, but slightly more exposed to the wind, Rob notes. Anything for a little privacy. By the time the last tent peg is in the ground, Tuck has some water boiling in a small pot, which is perched precariously on his stove and surrounded by a circle of rocks, apparently left by someone who camped here before. Several packages of dehydrated food are spread out on his poncho, along with instant soup, trail mix, and several assorted candy bars. Okay, guys, come and get it. The rain has turned into a steady, cold drizzle. They can hear the wind howling across the bluff above them, but the trees manage to blunt most of its force, permitting them to stand under the pine roof of their little grove in their slickers and consume Tuck's hot meal with considerable relish. What did you do to the soup, Tuck? Anne asks. It's delicious. Her woolen mittens cradle the cup for warmth. A touch of brandy, my dear. She knows a lot. I'll stay in my tent tonight, my dear. Within 3 minutes, the dehydrated package turns into hot beef stew, and by the time the rain really begins to penetrate the tree cover, they have been well fed. Tuck, old boy, you're the top, Rob says appreciatively. When I'm on the bottom, you're the top, Tuck croons. Hey, we'd better get in our tents, or we're going to get soaked. And I hope your tent is tight. It looks a bit exposed there. Don't worry, she says, it should be very dry, or at least it was the last time I used it. A sudden clap of thunder surprises them, and then the deluge begins. It is now almost completely dark on the bluff, even though it is barely past 5. Tuck and Rob scurry off into the woods to relieve their bladders. Standing under the relatively dry hemlock in his slicker, Rob wonders how Anne will cope when nature calls tonight. God, I'm glad I'm not a woman. Rob and Tuck have zipped a storm flap of their tent and are arranging their sleeping bags by the light of their headlamps. Their packs have been stowed outside under waterproof tarps. Their sweaters, toilet kits, boots, and water bottles are scattered around the inside of the narrow sloping tent walls. Holy Moses, Tuck says with a grunt as he tries to slide into his legs into his sleeping bag without poking Rob in the back. We're not getting any thinner or younger, are we? Yeah, but at least we're nice and dry. Anne's voice penetrates the tent fly directly above their heads. Tuck, I'm in trouble. My goddamn tent's rotted out and I'm getting soaked. Shit. Tuck's whisper is just loud enough so that she can hear him. Then louder. Do you want me to come out and try to fix it? It's no goddamn good. Most of the seams have rotted out and it just collapsed from the weight of the rain. I don't know what to do. They think for a moment. Rob calls out to her. There's not much room in here, but I guess we'll have to make do. I'll open the flap for you. A puddle of water flows into the entrance when Rob unzips the storm flap. Anne's dripping face appears in the beam of Tuck's headlamp as she crawls in heads first between the bags like a cold, wet fish. Sorry about this, fellas. Jesus, you are really wet, Anne, Tuck exclaims. I know it, goddammit. Why do you think I'm here? Her head is now jammed into the narrow back of the tent, and her wet, muddy boots are desecrating the hitherto clean and dry entrance. Where's your sleeping bag? Tuck asks. Christ, I left it back in my tent. I'll get it, Tuck says nobly, hating her for screwing up. He emerges from his sleeping bag in his underpants, struggles back into his windbreaker and topsiders, and opens the flap again, creating another minor waterfall. He returns in a few minutes and pushes Anne's wet sleeping bag in her general direction. She has managed to turn around facing the entrance and is occupying as little of his space as possible. Tuck removes his topsiders and slides into his bag. You'd better try to fit between us. She struggles to unroll, then unzips her sleeping bag, and after much maneuvering gets in, struggles out of her hiking pants and tosses them into the back of the tent. Well, here we all are, Rob says gamely, wondering what Cynthia would think of this. He has now shifted as far as he can to the right of the tent and can feel the tattoo of the rain vibrating on the wall of the fly, under the fly. Anne is almost on top of him in the middle, and he can feel a root sticking up in the back of the small of his back. He flicks on his headlamp and looks at his watch. It is only 6:20 in pitch black. This is going to be a long night, he thinks. Tuck is reading the paperback. Anne, do you mind if I read a bit? The temperature has dropped a few degrees more, and you can see his breath fogging the airspace under the dome of the roof. I don't care what you do, Tuck, she says from inside her bag. She is shivering with her hands clamped between her wet knees and begins to weep silently, overcome by cold, anger, and fatigue. The Appalachian Trail leads off Mount Everett, down into Sage's Ravine, crosses the Connecticut border, climbs over Bear Mountain, and then makes an easy wooded descent through Mountain Laurel along a soft pine needle path. It emerges onto Route 41, just a mile from the outskirts of Salisbury, then passes by the White Birch Inn, which attracts a flock of tourists who come to view the foliage, as well as an occasional hiker passing through. So that's Night Trail. Before we get to open book exam, I should say that I first conceived of publishing a normal paperback with the two novellas stacked one on top of each other, the first one and then the second one. And Eloise and I both used a very talented book designer named Kate Canfield, who lives in Cambridge, and I recommend her heartily if any of you are looking for somebody to put a book together. And she came up with the idea for me because of these two novellas. Simone already showed it, having one book obviously looking straight at you, and then when you turn, you have to flip it over and you can go back and read the second one from front to back too, and they coincide, they collide in the middle upside down. I think it's kind of cool, and it's a neat solution to a problem. It's very clever. She didn't think of it, it's been done before, but I think it really worked for me. So, on to open book exam. As I mentioned earlier, there are four couples in this book, in this book club, and I'll just give you their names because you'll hear their names come up during the dialogue. Parker and Barbara Story, Michael and Libby Wittenberg, David Perkins and Carol Stein, who are husband and wife, and then Trudy Poor and Jesse Lloyd. And he's a 45-year-old bachelor. He's a minister who's just joined the club after Trudy's husband ran off with their interior decorator. The Story's daughter, Laura, is 30 years old and she lives nearby. She's a teacher in a Catholic boarding school in New Milford. And she's the principal character in a subplot in the novel. There are several other characters They're hard hat, blue collar, tough guys, real people. And they do the dirty work keeping the elite safe in their somewhat sheltered lives. If you aren't a member of a book club, this novella may not appeal to you, but keep an open mind. It contains some intelligent discussion of 8 great books, some amusing conversation, and even better, sex, violence, and action. Incidentally, Eloise and I are members of a book club, which has been in existence since 1985. Over the course of the novella, there are 8 books that are discussed. The Mayor of Casterbridge by Thomas Hardy. I'm not going to ask for a show of hands to see how many have read these things. The Adventures of Tom Sawyer by Mark Twain. King Lear, William Shakespeare. Lady Chatterley's Lover, D.H. Lawrence. Couples, John Updike. Sex. Candide by Voltaire. The Book of Job, Old Testament. And Our Town by Thornton Wilder. This list could be sort of the syllabus for a great books course in a college, general education course. It's helpful in writing the book that our book club has discussed most of them, and actually several were my own choices, so I had some background in them and I'd be able to incorporate the discussion as the novella moves on. The idea that each couple is going to discuss one of these books as the novella plows on from beginning to end. I'm going to read a section from the beginning of Open Book Exam. The book club is meeting in the home of Parker and Barbara Story in Brookfield, Connecticut. It is September 2016. Parker is 65. He's a graduate of Yale College and Yale Law School. He's a Vietnam veteran, having been an officer in the Navy. He's now a successful real estate developer, a town moderator, and serves on several charitable boards. He and Barbara have invited their daughter, Laura, to join them for dinner because her school, where she stays in Brookfield, Connecticut, very close, and come for dinner and join the group discussing the Mayor of Casterbridge. They have, Parker and Barbara would have what many would be considered to have a really very enviable life. Except that their oldest son, Parky, inexplicably committed suicide 2 years ago, leaving a wife and 2 children. The discussion in the living room during cocktails had gone well. Parker gave a brief summary of Hardy's life and works, while the rest of the party sipped their drinks and consumed the crackers, brie, and pâté from a plate which was passed around. Log fire spat and crackled occasionally from some sap, which hadn't quite cured over the summer. Barbara watched Parker fondly during his usual organized presentation, as he occasionally glanced down at his notes with his reading glasses perched on the end of his nose. Michael Wittenberg interrupted several times, and his wife Libby, who owned a Bridgewater bookstore, hushed him up. "Please, Michael, let Parker finish." David Perkins, the courtly professor, he's a retired Yale professor, who actually knew more about Hardy than anyone in the room, smiled beatifically from his chair, his cane lying next to him on the floor. His wife Carol spent most of the discussion flipping through the pages of the paperback edition, looking for relevant passages. She held out her wine glass to be refilled whenever Barbara circled the room with a Sauvignon Blanc. Carol always appeared as if she had just finished running a 10K, and one of her legs twitched rhythmically. Laura looked so cute, wearing a lovely fitted tweed blazer, slacks, and a silk scarf around her neck in the French style. She had that healthy glow of an athletic young woman in the prime of life. The minister and Trudy sat next to each other on the sofa and seemed to be getting along famously. Jesse had dressed casually tonight, no collar, and his soft loafers were nicely polished. Trudy looked pleased and smiled at him whenever he passed her the cheese plate. Her neckline was low, but not too low. "Let's move in for dinner so we can discuss the book in more detail. Parker, do you want to get the swordfish started on the grill while I put the soup on the table?" "Righto," said Parker. He poured himself half a glass of wine and headed for the grill out on the deck. He looked in the mirror on the way out and thought he saw his son parking, dirt being reflected in the glass. Barbara's dessert was in front of them now. Parker had opened up another bottle of wine and was again circling the table. His mother's four candlesticks had been polished for the occasion and reflected the glow of their candles. The portraits of Barbara's grandparents glared down at them from their assigned places on the walls. She always joked that they were wearing itchy undergarments. All right, said Michael. Parker has done his usual thorough job. We've torn through the street plot, so now we understand who's fallen in love with whom and how and when. But we haven't really nailed Hardy's central message. And what is that, Mr. Smartest guy in the room, murmured Carol with a wink at David. It's right there on the last page, screaming at us. Happiness is but the occasional episode in a general drama of pain. Trudy sat up in her chair. I think Hardy's got it exactly right. Look at the misery in this world, poverty, war, homelessness, disease. Most of us around this table have been hurt badly in one way or another, and we're the lucky ones. She turned to Jesse, the minister, who was about the position of a piece of apple pie on his fork. Her forefinger pointed directly at his chest. So what's the answer, Mr. Lloyd? Why do we suffer? Jesse grinned as he put his fork back down on the plate. This is definitely shaping up as a tough initiation for me. Incidentally, my sermon tomorrow deals with some of the same issue, why bad things happen to good people. Lots of books have been written about the subject, but I'm sorry there aren't any really good answers without getting into the nature of God, and I don't want to ruin your dinner. He looked over at David Perkins. What do you think, Professor? I know that you taught a course on the human condition at Yale. It's a fascinating subject, Perkins responded. Probably the most fascinating one of all. I taught two courses, actually. One was a literature course for undergraduates. The other was at the Divinity School. I used to ask my students to list all the worst aspects of life so that we could explore them in literature and philosophy. I agree with you, Jesse. There are no easy answers. And sometimes the answers are the ones you don't want to hear. Laura broke in. You know what would be really interesting? We could go around the table and list what's bugging us. Maybe we could start with the little things before we get really serious. Thomas Hardy can wait, don't you think? All right, said Barbara. I'll go first, if I may. What really bugs me is to see a family sitting at a nice restaurant, and every one of them is looking at his or her cell phone. No one is talking, no one is communicating. It's really sad. And suddenly we tell people to turn their cell phones off. Isn't that the truth, said Libby. These young millennials come into my store, browse around for half an hour, and they finally select the book. They'll hold up people while they're standing at the register and talk for 3 minutes to a friend on their iPhone. I'm afraid it's worse with the young mothers. Cell phones in one hand and Starbucks coffee in the other. Yes, dear, Michael interjected, but you can't do cell phones. Barbara already did that. All right, let me see. Donald Trump. No, that's too easy. Okay, you know what bugs me? Now, Laura, don't take offense, but people your age are using the word like mindlessly, almost 3 or 4 times in a sentence. Here's what I hear every day. She shifted into an acting mode as she impersonated a customer. So I'm in the Bell and Candle bookstore, and I'm about to buy this book. So the lady behind the counter is like waiting for my Visa card to go through. And it turns out the goddamn card is overdrawn. So I go, could I like take the book now and come back with my American Express card, which I always keep in my Louis Vuitton purse? And the bitch goes, no way. I'm like bummed out. So I go, screw you, and I'm out of there. The book club broke into sustained applause and Libby grinned. That's absolutely perfect, said David. And you know what's really troubling? That generation, sorry, Laura, I'm not referring to you, of course. That generation is now moving into the ranks of the teaching profession. So, Laura, please save us from the apocalypse. I'll do my best, Professor, I promise. It's not as bad as you think. When my friends get into a classroom with our students, we get, like, really serious. More laughter and applause. Parker was pleased with the way the evening was going. Your turn, David. In your career, there must have surely been many dark moments. They all turned to Perkins. Well, to get a bit serious, I found in my last 2 years of teaching that I was imperceptibly slipping. On several days, I forgot the names of some of my students, or I would have to refer to my old notes during lectures. I began to worry about Alzheimer's. So I decided to retire early, and luckily the problem more or less solved itself. So I submit old age as the thing which really bugs me. Not very original or profound, I'm afraid. He glanced at Carol and smiled. Carol said, "Sweetie, you forgot to mention that you had just gone through a nasty divorce just so that you could marry me. That's a lot of stress. And as we all know, stress isn't good for any of us. Incidentally, if I can get to go now, my card in this game is stress. And incidentally, an atheist Jewish who is accused of breaking up a Yale professor's marriage is going to get one hell of a lot of stress thrown at her. Parker, where's that wine bottle? And yes, Parker, you've been hiding behind your insufferable wasp manners for too long. It's your turn." Parker came around and filled her glass, giving her a gentle kiss on the forehead. "Carol, no one could figure out why our beloved David walked out on Melissa to marry you. But now we can see why. You won't let him die of boredom." "Hear, hear," filled the room. Carol blew Parker a kiss, and David rose to shake his hand. "Carol's right, Parker. It's your turn." He rounded the table once more and squeezed Laura's neck affectionately when he got to her place. "All right, guys, it's my turn. Let's see. Washing the dishes after the guests have all left." Boos from the group. "Double faulting on match point. Happens quite often," Barbara called out, laughing. "I've got it. Erectile dysfunction." Laura, "Dad!" Barbara, "Don't worry, darling. He's just kidding." Michael, pouncing from the end of the table, "Happens quite often." The party was in full swing now. Laura's cell phone went off in her purse, which was by her feet. Damn. She struggled to retrieve it as it jangled away, finally found it and glanced at the screen. "Excuse me." She went into the kitchen for a moment and returned looking sheepish. "Sorry, everybody." Jesse helped her into her chair. "All right, Laura, this was your idea. Tell us what's on your mind, but you've got to bring Hardy back into the discussion somehow." She got up and looked around the table. "I feel as if I'm about to make an oral presentation for my master's degree. Well, what's bugging me right now is a stupid male teacher at St. Catherine's, who's making the most obvious run at me. He just called to check in, even though I told him I was having dinner with all of you. He's just a bit creepy. No, Mom, I can handle it." The table had grown quiet. "So how does this tie into Hardy?" she continued. "Well, remember the book begins with Michael Henschiger auctioning off his wife while he's in a drunken stupor. Even though the novel is set in the early 1800s, and there are obviously different cultural norms at that time, it's absolutely shocking that a stupid man could sell his wife for a piddling amount of money. So what's bugging me tonight? Men, that's what." She sat down to laughter and cheers. And that's all we have.